Welcome to Myth Matters, storytelling and conversation about mythology and what myth can offer us today. I'm your host and personal mythologist, Dr. Catherine Svela. Wherever you may be in this wide, beautiful, crazy world of ours, you are part of this story circle. April is National Poetry Month here in the United States, and today I want to celebrate that with you. Myth and poetry have a long shared history. In fact, our oldest known myths are poems. The connection between myth-telling and poetry is the root of culture around the world. You may think of Homer and the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the Homeric hymns. Homer is not the first recorded poet and mythmaker, however. That distinction belongs to Enheduanna, a Sumerian priestess in the temple of the goddess Inanna and teller of Inanna's myths. Myth and poetry go way back, but have you ever wondered why this might be? I suspect the intuitive rightness of myth as poetry springs from the ancient understanding of the sacred power of the word to evoke, call forth, and create the world. The etymology of the words is interesting. Myth, from Greek mythos, is generally agreed to be pre-Greek, of unknown origins, a word that the Greeks came across and incorporated into their language. Mythos meant speech, thought, conversation, story, any of these forms, which were understood as synonymous or more so than we often imagine them today. Any of these forms delivered by word of mouth. Poem, from the Greek poema, comes from the root poen, to make or complete. And a poem is a thing made or created. Greeks often referred to the art of poet and playwright, those crafting language and culture, as mythopoesis, the making of myth. Myths also describe the creative power of words. In the Vedic texts of the Hindus, for example, the goddess Vak is the divine word of creation, the initial breath of life that is rekindled in the singing of sacred songs and poetry. The creation myth in the book of Genesis is the story of a god who created heaven and earth through speech. Let there be light. Our words call forth the literal, name of the visible, and also invoke hidden dimensions, unseen presences, and the interiority of seemingly ordinary things. A poet writes of a stone, a rug, a cup of coffee, and these are transformed, right? In a sense, every poem can take you into the world of the gods, quote unquote, whether or not this is explicit or religious in the formal sense. Word as image, the image in the word activates the mind's eye. Our ancestors honored the power of spoken word in the earliest forms of writing also. For example, the Egyptians didn't record the dark deeds of their gods in their sacred hieroglyphs, so these events wouldn't be inscribed too deeply into the nature of the world. Many of us have gotten so careless with this great power of words. This is worth thinking about if you measure your impact and contribution to this time. Poetry requires the precise use of words, the right words in the right order, as someone said. The poet attends to the meaning and function of each word, hence the condensed form. People who study language note that the difference between prose and poetry, which the poet Paul Valéry described as the difference between walking and dancing, that this difference between prose and poetry appears to be ingrained in our consciousness. We recognize it, like the forms of story from our earliest days. This recognition stems from the relationship between breath, body, sound, and speech that is integral to poetry. The sound of a word, as well as meaning. The way the sound of a word conveys meaning. The appearance of words on the page in lines. The conventions of verses, and how this guides the breath. I encourage you to read some poetry out loud if you don't already do so. Read a poem out loud or commit one to memory. Speak it with the power, and you may be amazed. A poem can bring you to life, feeling, thought, and creation. So today, I have a handful of poems that reference myths. This is a mythology podcast, after all. And myth is still a great source of material for poets and artists. I mean, the myths are great stories, right, with compelling figures. And because they have endured, they are very rich cultural touchstones and sources of metaphors that extend beyond the story proper. And also, I think myths continue to be such a great source of creative material because every myth is a mystery or a series of mysteries. Every myth contains unanswered and perhaps unanswerable questions. This is why they lend themselves to multiple interpretation and to this ongoing and infinite process of mythopoiesis, of making and remaking. When you take up a myth through art, in this case, poetry, you approach it in the manner of its existence. And by that I mean you meet the mystery, power with power, and you have a chance to explore these questions at the heart of the story and the mysteries for yourself. Now, you'll hear this in the poems that I have for you today. And maybe the poet's explorations can fuel your own thoughts about these myths. So I invite you to relax and listen. Let the sounds and the words flow over you and through you. You might hear a great word, one that feels potent in your mouth, or get an idea, or find a poem or a poet of interest, or have an interesting break in your day. Now, on to the poems. I'll share a little background on the myth each poet is working as well. This first one is called Ariadne by Oliver Turrell. Now, Ariadne is the princess of Crete and daughter of King Minos. And King Minos has the Minotaur. The Minotaur, the bull-headed monster who is locked away in the labyrinth. And the Minotaur is fed a tribute of young people who are sent from the city of Athens every year, every 7 years, I think it is, as a sacrifice. In the story, the myth that involves Ariadne, the Greeks have arrived, and one of these young people is the hero, Theseus. Ariadne sees him. They fall in love. She helps him find his way into the labyrinth to kill the Minotaur and back out again by giving him a ball of thread. Of course, once they do this, they have to quickly sail away before they're captured. And the very first morning, then, she wakes up on this island alone. She's been abandoned. Or has she? Ariadne is discovered by the god Dionysus, who marries her. There are a lot of open questions about Theseus and Ariadne and what went on there. So, here is a poem by Oliver Turrell. It was amazing luck to get that clue. Threading between the darkened outer rooms, he sought escape, the bull's head in his arms. The bass was thumping as the blood within. She, grateful for assistance, guided him outwards, his half-drunk feet still holding true. They bounced it past the guards, so they were free. Not Crete, but Mykonos. Through the summer's heat, an adrenaline made the whole street a haze. Too soon to speak of love, they spoke of everything except love. Favorite books, weird kinks, lost hours, first memories, last regrets, worst fears. It wasn't him abandoned her. The stars made sure of it that they should walk apart. The memory is good. But that's tonight. Morning will come and take it all away. To see girt Daya, wherever that was, she went. He weaving home, slowly losing the thread. That was Ariadne by Oliver Turrell. Now this next poem also takes place on Crete in a story that overlaps with Ariadne. The creator of the labyrinth in which the Minotaur was imprisoned or housed, depending on how you want to look at it, was created by Diatlus, who was considered to be the greatest inventor who ever lived. And he was kept a prisoner on Crete by King Minos, and he had a young son named Icarus. Diatlus very much wanted to escape with his son. Watching birds fly led him to create for the two of them feathered wings held together by wax. And one day, the two of them leapt off of a high place on the island, flapping their wings. Diatlus warned his young son Icarus not to fly too high and too close to the sun. However, the young man did not listen to his father. He was exhilarated by the experience of flight. The wax on his wings melted, and he fell into the sea. This moment is the moment explored by W.H. Auden in his poem called Musée des Beaux-Arts. And it references a painting by Bruegel, which I will post on my website. Musée des Beaux-Arts. About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along, how, when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there always must be children who do not especially want it to happen. skating on a pond at the edge of the wood. They never forgot that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course. Anyhow, in a corner, some untidy spot, where the dogs go on with their doggy life and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The plowman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry. But for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone as it had onto the white legs disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to, and sailed calmly on. I love the way that Auden reflects on the ongoing and persistent existence of suffering and disaster in our midst, and how we live despite it, because so much of it doesn't concern us personally. And the way this is conveyed in this famous painting, there's an accumulation of meaning here that connects us to the ancients. Like I say, I'll post that painting on the Mythic Mojo website. Now, I have another Greek myth that's wrapped in questions that can never be resolved. These are mysteries, I think, of love and obsession, violence and innocence, initiation, awakening, sexuality, the secret chambers of the heart. And you may have guessed it, this is a poem that references the myth of the goddess Persephone, daughter of the goddess Demeter. And Persephone was carried away by her uncle Hades, who was god of the underworld, one fine spring day, plucked like a flower, and taken to be queen of the depths. How did she feel about going? Did she want to stay once she got there? Persephone and her mother, Demeter, are often associated with the passing of the changing of the seasons, with the emergence of spring and the onset of fall and winter, those being the months when Persephone is down below ground. And yet, as powerful and important as that earth cycle symbolism is, it doesn't exhaust the myth. Anyway, I'll stop there. This poem is called A Myth of Devotion by Louise Gluck. When Hades decided he loved this girl, he built for her a duplicate of earth, everything the same, down to the meadow, but with a bed added. Everything the same, including sunlight, because it would be hard on a young girl to go so quickly from bright light to utter darkness. Gradually, he thought, he'd introduce the night, first as the shadows of fluttering leaves, then moon, then stars, then no moon, no stars. Let Persephone get used to it slowly. In the end, he thought, she'd find it comforting. A replica of Earth. Except there was love here. Doesn't everyone want love? He waited many years, building a world, watching Persephone in the meadow. Persephone, a smeller, a taster. If you have one appetite, he thought, you have them all. Doesn't everyone want to feel in the night the beloved body, compass, pole star, to hear the quiet breathing that says, I am alive, that means also you are alive, because you hear me, You are here with me. And when one turns, the other turns. That's what he felt, the Lord of Darkness, looking at the world he had constructed for Persephone. It never crossed his mind that there'd be no smelling here, certainly no more eating. Guilt? Terror? The fear of love? These things he couldn't imagine. No lover ever imagines them. He dreams. He wonders what to call this place. First, he thinks, the new hell. Then, the garden. In the end, he decides to name it Persephone's Girlhood. A soft light rising above the level meadow behind the bed. He takes her in his arms. He wants to say, I love you. Nothing can hurt you. But he thinks, this is a lie. So he says in the end, you're dead. Nothing can hurt you. Which seems to him a more promising beginning. More true. That's A Myth of Devotion by Louise Gluck. Now, in this next one, we're going to step away from the Greeks and turn to a poem that talks about Ogun, the Yoruba god of war, iron, the hunt, the road, patron saint of blacksmiths. Ogun is able to link the worlds of the dead, the living, and the unborn. And he's part of the mythological tradition of Nigerian playwright, poet, political activist, Wole Soyinka. You may recognize the name Soyinka. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1986. And this poem is in his collection, Idanra and Other Poems. Now, Idanra, I discovered, is the name of a sacred hill in Nigeria. And Soyinka went there. And I love what he says about mythology and religion. He asks, do I really need one? A religion. I have never felt I needed one. I am a mythologist. So no, I don't worship any deity, but I consider deities as creatively real and therefore my companions in my journey in both the real world and the imaginative world. This is so much in line with the way that we talk about myth here, and myth matters. That it is crucially important, and that the gods and these events are presences in our lives, but they're not things to literally believe in. So, on that note, what is the myth? Well, according to Yoruban mythology, the gods once lived here on Earth with human beings, and there was a relationship of mutual camaraderie and regard. But then humans disbehaved. The gods withdrew into the heavens. And there was a lot of chaos here, with the gods sometimes trying to bridge the gap in various ways. And ultimately, both the gods and the mortals came to Ogun and asked him to resolve the breach. And he cut through, you know, all kinds of chaotic growth and plants and moved stones. And I mean, he reopened the road between the gods and the mortals, which is why he is the god of roads. Well, once he did that, the people wanted him to be their king, but he really didn't want to assume that role, and so he tried to discourage them by showing up in a very bloody, violent way, just reminding them of, you know, his destructive side. And this frightened them, and they ran away, and he went back into solitude. But the elders came back and asked him once again to come down and be their king and to please just be less terrifying. And so he did come down and do that. Now, in Soyinka's view, human beings have unfortunately chosen to embody the negative side of this unpredictable and violent God. And that is also one of the themes in this poem, which is called The Beginning. Low beneath rock shields, home of the Iron One, the sun had built a fire within Earth's heartstone. Flames and fever fits ran in rock fissures, and the hill surfaces were all aglow with Earth's transparency. Orisa and La, Orinmulya, Isu, Ifa were all assembled, defeated in the quest to fraternize with man. Wordlessly he rose, sought knowledge in the hills. Ogun, the lone one, saw it all, the secret veins of matter and the circling lodes. Sango's spent thunderbolt served him a hammerhead. His fingers touched earth core, and it yielded. To think, a mere plague of finite chaos stood between the gods and man. He made a mesh of elements from stone of fire and earth fruit, the womb of energies. He made an anvil of the peaks and kneaded red clay for his mold. In his hands, the weapon gleamed, born of the primal mechanic. And this pledge he gave the heavens, I will clear a path to man. His task was ended. He declined the crown of deities, sought retreat in heights. But ire lied skilled siege to divine withdrawal. Alas, for diplomatic arts, the elders of ire prevailed. He descended, and they crowned him king. Who speaks to me and chants recesses? Who guides the finger's eye? Now he climbs in reparation, who anointed Godhead in carnage. Oh, let heaven loose the bolts of last season's dam, for him to lave his fingers merely, and in the heady line of blood, vultures drown. Merely, and in the lung streams of depleted pastures, earth is flattened. Oh, the children of Ogun reaped red earth harvest. Rain is children's reeds, and the sky a bird pond, until my God has bathed his hands. Who brings a god to supper, guard him well, and set his place with a long bamboo pole. Ogun is the lascivious god who takes seven gourdlets to war. One for gunpowder, one for charms, two for palm wine, and three air-sealed in polished bronze makes storage for his sperms. My god, Ogun, orphan shield, his home is terraced hills self-surmounting to the skies. Ogun, pathmaker, he who goes for where other gods have turned. Shield of orphans, was your shield inspiked that day on sheltering lives? Yet, had he fled when his primal task was done, fugitive from man and god, ever seeking hills and rock bounds. In Donre's granite offered peace, and there he dwelt until the emissaries came. Lead us, king and warlord. Who speaks to me? I cannot tell. Who guides the hammer's flight? Gods drowse in boredom, and their pity is easily roused with lush, obsequious rites, because the rodent nibbled somewhat at his yam. The farmer hired a hunter, filled him with wine, and thrust a firebrand in his hand. We do not burn the woods to trap a squirrel. We do not ask the mountain's aid to crack a walnut. That's The Beginning by Wul Soyinka from Indonre and Other Poems. So I have one more for you, and it's not about a specific myth. Rather, I think it speaks about one of the questions that most intrigues me, and one that the myths touch upon again and again. The question of who or what designs a life? Is it fate? Free will? Chance? Luck? The will of the gods? How much do we plan? How many of the things that really shape our lives are brought about consciously by us? And if it's some combination of these forces, in what measure? This existential mystery animates so much of life and art and myth. It's a topic we take up and turn over again and again, and a motivation for that exploration. This is also a wonderful poem to speak out loud. It's called Serpentine by Billy Collins. And I love this poem. Serpentine. This morning I saw suddenly on the road ahead of me the moving question mark of a snake, black thumb of a head lifted, some ancient node within the dark hood urging the long thin body forward, sensing its way through its slippery existence as it had been doing since birth, slithering toward our moment of intersection, the swishing passage no longer hidden by grass or the wet cover of leaves, but its entire length visible now in the pure daylight of this dilated second. Just as I had been moving toward it, too, all my life, in my own upright, warm-blooded way, walking the long sidewalks, riding trains, leaning on the railing of a ferry, or as today, driving a country road, which from the air would look like a snake itself curling through the dense green woods. No moment was given there spacious enough to break or swerve within, only time enough to keep my line, hoping without hope, knowing as I needled through the instant that the two of us had always been meant to meet here, my curved line crossing his as on some unknowable graph, spread out on a vast table under the glare of a hanging lamp, a relentless diagram, millions of faint red lines forming millions of tiny squares. That's Serpentine by Billy Collins. Now, I want to close with a few paragraphs from an essay that I found by Jeanette Winterson. She was writing a review of a book of poetry by Carol Duffy called The World's Wife. And this is an awesome book of poetry. They're so funny. I will probably read you a poem or two in the next episode. Well, this is Winterson's essay is great. And I love the beginning, these few paragraphs about poetry. I will post the link to the entire essay, but I can't resist reading you these opening paragraphs. Winterson writes, "Poetry is pleasure. Sometimes people say to me, why should I read a poem? There are plenty of answers, from the profound, a poem is such an ancient means of communication that it feels like an evolutionary necessity, to the practical, a poem is like a shot of espresso, the fastest way to get a hit of mental and spiritual energy. We could talk about poetry as a rope in a storm, poetry is one continuous mantra of mental health. Poetry as the world's biggest, longest-running workshop on how to love. Poetry as a conversation across time. Poetry as the acid scrub of cliché. We could say that the poem is a lie detector, that the poem is a way of thinking without losing the feeling, that a poem is a way of feeling without being too overwhelmed by feeling to think straight, that the poem is the best words in the best order, Coleridge, that the poem keeps the heart awake to truth and beauty, Coleridge again, who can resist those romantics, that the poem is an intervention, the capacity to make change in existing conditions, as Muriel Rukeyser said, that poetry, said Seamus Heaney, is strong enough to help. Strong enough to help. So I'll post the link to Winterson's essay on the website in case you want to check that out. Now, before I go, I want to tell you about the workshop offered by my friend and colleague, Bob Walter, at Esalen. Bob was Joseph Campbell's editor and friend, and he guided the Joseph Campbell Foundation, which he founded, for over 30 years. He has lots of mythological cred, in other words, and Bob is offering his mythological toolbox workshop called Revisioning Your Hero's Journey at Esalen Institute in California from May 21st to 26th. He frames this experience with an important question. Do you dare to reimagine yourself? Do you dare to reimagine yourself? I know from experience that working this mythic material with Bob at Esalen is a potent combination. I will post the link to details about the mythological toolbox on the Mythic Mojo website, and I encourage you to take a look at it and consider joining Bob Walter for 6 days of inspired, creative, chaotic, joyful, and challenging play at the extraordinary Esalen Institute in beautiful Big Sur. A big, big welcome to new email subscribers, Halima, Lind, Kathy, and Linda. Welcome. If you are new to Myth Matters, I invite you to head over to the Mythic Mojo website. You will find a transcript of this episode, information about Story Oracle readings and my consulting services and other offerings. And you can join the email list too if you would like to receive links to new episodes in your inbox. Thank you, thank you, thank you to the Patreon patrons and Bandcamp supporters of Myth Matters. I want to give a shout out to new patron, Catherine. Thank you. And if you are finding something of value here at Myth Matters, I hope you'll consider joining me on Patreon too. Your few dollars a month make a big difference to me. If we have a better understanding of our need for myth and all that our old stories offer, we can live more satisfying lives. We can inhabit a better story and create a more beautiful, just, and sustainable world. I hope you enjoyed the poetry today and that you've got a couple interesting things to think about in terms of the power of the word. This is a power that each of us wields daily. And that's it for me, Catherine Savela, and Myth Matters. Thank you so much for listening. Take good care of yourself, and until next time, keep the mystery in your life alive.